Welcome to the latest edition of the Gaming Legacy Podcast. My guest today is Frank Fahrenkopf, the former president, CEO, and founder of the American Gaming Association. When gaming began to be legalized across the U.S., casino executives realized the industry had no representation in Washington, D.C., so they turned to the former chairman of the Republican Party during the Reagan administration, Frank Fahrenkopf, a Nevada resident. Although it was only supposed to be a short-term appointment, Fahrenkopf spent 18 years at the helm of the AGA. In the latest Gaming Legacy podcast, Fahrenkopf sat down with me at the Nantucket Yacht Club in Massachusetts, where he has a summer home. He discusses the formation and history of the AGA, but also touches on some current issues in the gaming industry, such as prediction markets and the state of politics in the United States. Welcome to the Gaming Legacy Podcast. My guest today is Frank Fahrenkopf, the former president and CEO and the founder of the American Gaming Association. And Frank, we go back a long way, and it's really an honor to be able to sit down and talk to you about this.
Well, it's been good to see you again, Raj.
So let's, of course, we're going to talk about the past, but I want to talk about the present at this point. I want to get your views on what's happening with the predictions market. It seems like this is a real existential threat to gaming, and it goes against everything that you stood for and that the AGA stood for all these years.
No question. You know, regulation, while most people scream that there's too much regulation in any business,
it's
the heart of our business, the gaming business, existing and being trusted by the gaming public, people who like to go to Las Vegas or Atlantic City or wherever there are casinos. And it's very, very important. And what this is doing is just incredibly bad. Now, it's been out there, though, in a different way for a long, long time. And it still goes. There's so many offshore companies that are taking bets that without regulations. And I know government's got to do a better job closing it down. And I'm hoping that's what's happening here. One of the things we were always concerned about, and, I mean, John McCain was a very, very close friend of mine. I was on his board. We worked together on a lot of things, but we disagreed with something. He was always concerned that gaming was going to, in a way, hurt the sports industry.
Sure, right.
And little did he realize at the time when we used to have these arguments that it was, I think it was Arizona State, where was playing in Washington, as I remember, and there was a real question as to whether or not someone was shaving points. And it turned out the FBI came in, bookmakers in Las Vegas contacted, knew something was wrong, and it came, and it was. And it was a terrible, he was very embarrassed by it, and he changed his mood.
Yeah, and it was a University of Arizona team,
was that? That's exactly right. we have to have that integrity, and the people who enjoy gaming, want to be involved in it, have to realize that it's safe. And it's fair, and it's not crooked. And that's why what's going on right now without any regulation, and I'm just hoping that state governments, most states, I hope, are moving first, but then federal government's got to get involved and close it down.
Sure. Well, that was something you always tried to avoid, getting the federal government involved in gaming. Some people are suggesting now we need a federal czar overseeing sports betting and this kind of thing. Would that be good or bad for the industry?
No, I don't think that's we've always been, the states have to do it. But and have to regulate it. We always were afraid of it. That's when the National Gaming Impact Study Commission was created. Their goal it was Paul Simon in the United States Senate, a Democrat, and Frank Wolf in the House, a Republican, who were out to destroy the gaming industry. They didn't want the gaming industry at all to be involved, and that's what we. It's what first real challenge the American Gaming Association had. We traveled all over the United States where there were meetings of the commission. You were at a lot of those places. And we were fortunate in that I was able to, with the help of former Senator and Majority Leader Reid, Harry helped me make sure that the members of the commission, we had representatives of our industry. both sides, the union and operators, and of course we had the Bible from Las Vegas, and we came out of that very, very well.
Sure. Well, we're going to get into that a little later on, but I want to go all the way back to the beginning and how you got involved in gaming. Obviously, you were, I know you were born in Brooklyn like I was, so we're both Dodger fans.
But I did a little bit of work before the Nevada Gaming Commission early on as a lawyer in Reno for some clients. But what really motivated things was after President Reagan named me the chairman of the Republican National Committee, and I moved to Washington, and I saw what was going on the Hill, where every industry of any concern had lobbyists, had organizations that represented them, that appeared before Congress and in White House, whoever was in the White House, Republican or Democrat, and the gaming industry didn't. And so when Skip Avancino was the president of Hilton, they had a board meeting in Washington, D.C., and Skip called me, and we grabbed a bite to eat together. And I said to him, I said, you know, our industry is going to be in danger. There were already rumors around that the Clinton administration, primarily pushed by Mrs. Clinton, wanted to increase taxes on the industry, and that something had to be done. There had to be some representation, and both sides of the coin showed. He went back and talked to Baron Hilton. Baron got busy talking to some of the other members involved in the running companies in the industry, and eventually they came to me and asked me to be the first chairman, and I told them I wasn't interested. I had a pretty good law practice in Washington, D.C. at the time, but I would help them. And so Chuck Mathewson from IGT, Steve Wynn, and Skip, who was still president of Hilton, were a team that came back to Washington, hired a headhunter who interviewed, I think it was like 5 to 10 people, including a former United States senator, one of the former wife of one of the Hope family, who was a federal judge, retired, and they still couldn't make up their mind. So they did come to me and ask me if I would consider doing it for just a year to get it off the ground. And I said, well, let me talk to my partners. And they said, okay, let's give it a shot. And that I started it, and I was only there for 17, 18 years.
Exactly, yes. Right. So at that point, though, in the early 90s, there wasn't a huge industry. I mean, certainly it was Nevada, New Jersey, and some riverboat states that had opened by that time.
The Indians were starting to.
The Indians, of course, right?
Yes.
But you were representing the commercial casinos, not the Indians.
That's
at that
correct.
Point. So at, how did you influence some of the legislators from states that didn't have gaming, and also how did you encourage states that didn't have gaming to get gaming?
I think the real challenge came about when we started the board meetings of the AGA, and each of the companies that were involved, the chairman, and I had a rule. It had to be the decision maker from the university
for
each of the companies. I didn't want a vice president to come back and report and so forth. And that worked out very well. Not everyone joined right at the beginning. But one of the concerns that was out there was the whole question of people being addicted to gambling and they could ruin their lives and all the rest. There were some members of the board who were not supportive of doing anything about that. What I did at the first board meeting when we discussed this is I had a photograph that was taken of all the heads of the tobacco companies when they were brought before Congress. There's a picture of them all standing with their heads taking the oath. And I said, do you really want to get involved in this? And they said, all right, let's go for it. Let's think about it, see where we're going to go. And luckily, Phil Satre had attended, when he was in Paris, had attended a conference at Harvard, led by Dr. Schaefer, who the particular conference had to deal with addictive problems with young people, teenagers and so forth. And I then met up with Dr. Schaefer and convinced him that we would finance the creation of what later became, I forget, they changed the name on me now. Now it's International, whatever it might be.
International Center for Responsible Gaming.
The
NCRG,
and
right.
We would provide the financing to get the work done, to pay for the research and so forth. But there would be a Chinese wall there.
Right.
And that Chinese wall, we would not try to interfere with their decisions. Whatever the decision was, whatever the study showed, that would go out without us going forward. And he agreed.
That was a risky decision at the time because you didn't know. I mean, who would have known? How many people were seriously addicted?
Then you remember. Well, you got to help me remember how I can forget his name. He was It wasn't the Catholic Church. It was the Episcopal Church or the Presbyterian Church, one of the others. And he traveled around the country. I've debated it, but numerous times. I can't remember his name now. They claimed it was like 50-60% of the people. So, I had talked to the doctor a little bit before we went forward. We thought it was much less than that. And as you know, it's probably 2-3% eventually. And so we were lucky enough to go forward with it. Board signed on. I would much point out to Bill Boyd, who the industry really owes something for, because Bill was the first company that when we really had to do something money-wise,
right,
that he started it and was a strong supporter always over the years as we were creating the industry. Then the challenge began when Congressman Frank Wolf and Paul Simon created the Commission on Presidential Debates. That's something else that I do. I'm sorry. The study commission.
Yeah, National Impact Study Commission.
And
Gambling Impact Study.
The important thing for us is that we were well represented on that. We traveled, and we came out of that. Interestingly enough, our gaming industry came out in much better shape. I mean, one of the industries that would not get involved with, I tried to talk to them about it, was the lottery industry.
Right.
They would not know. They wouldn't have been involved in anything. And they came out very, very badly. Although, to be fair, I told everybody, let's face it, before the lotteries came, there was numbers rackets and almost everywhere.
Exactly right.
existed, but they didn't defend themselves. The horse racing industry also did not participate as much as I.
Yeah, they were there. I mean, you held a couple of meetings at racetracks. I remember the Del Mar one in particular.
But we came out of that, and we came out in really, really good shape.
Sure. And it was really the first study that actually looked at problem gambling and in an objective way. And it came out, between 1% and 2% were really the pathological problems.
Right. And so when you ask me how that affected other states that were going to consider going into the gaming industry, that was very, very important.
Right.
Because their concern was, of course, the best health and welfare of their citizens and voters. And that showed. Dr. Schaefer did such a marvelous job with his team at Harvard for all those years and going forward, and that was easy to sell. Now, to be fair, also, it wasn't also that convinced them. In so many states, governors and legislators looked at gaming as the golden egg.
Right, yeah, for sure.
And that's why we had some, who got a difficulty because of the tax rates that they imposed. But it slowly started to spread. The integrity that was there, the work that we did continuously, and a wonderful staff at our gaming association. They worked hard. We traveled all over the country and worked, and it slowly began to go strong. And then you have leadership. You got to look at Terry Lanning.
Sure.
Who was marvelous.
Yeah. Let's talk about the members. I mean, Terry Lanning, obviously the head of MGM at the time, a great guy. He died too young, but he played a huge role in that. Very classy guy.
Big role. You go through almost every single one of them came on board. Bill Boyd, and wherever you went, there was that support. And then Phil, was also he's still involved in the industry.
Sure.
right now. Maybe I shouldn't have passed him in the bar exam. I was on the Board of Bar Examination in Nevada when he got passed. I would have kidded him and said, it was marginal. I did pass.
Well, you also had John Wilhelm, the head of the Culinary Union.
He was fantastic. Mm-hmm. What a wonderful man John was. And he was so cooperative in working with us and with the team and so forth. We didn't get involved in those battles every couple of years.
Sure, right. Luckily, you were between contracts at that point. But then you had Bill Bybel as well, the former head of the Nevada Gaming Control Board.
Correct.
Another very low-key guy, but very influential. But then on the other side, you had probably the main anti-gaming guy, James Dobson, the head of Focus on the Family.
He just passed away.
I saw that. But
he was also kind of a decent guy.
He was, I was surprised.
where we went on these, we traveled all over the country on these hearings. He was like me, 7 o'clock in the morning on the treadmill in the hotel wherever we were, and he'd be next to me on the treadmill. And I'd say, Jim, take a good look. Have you ever in your career in religion, had a basement where you filled with people and you filled out bingo cards for him for his money. He would laugh and so forth. But he was, it was strong.
Yeah, for sure.
And, we were very, 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 very fortunate to come out as we did.
And then the chairwoman, Kay James, we thought it was going to be anti-gaming, but she was very fair and objective.
She was fair and objective, and I always thought that, Terry Lanning had a lot to do with that. Terry treated her with tremendous respect. And of course, I knew her for years through politics, and she was very, very fair, and the report was very balanced.
Right.
And it sort of, that was the end of, it was stifled what was going on on the Hill. And then the question was, where was it going to go state by state? Mm-hmm. What kind of regulatory reforms? And I always said, you got to talk to Nevada and talk to New Jersey. The seal of approval.
Right, right.
And most people did that.
So let's talk about how you went state by state. Was it the companies that wanted to get involved in those states that were leading those efforts? I think Station Casinos and Ameristar and some of those casinos were sort of riverboat states. And but Florida is the one that sticks in my head. And I think it's because Arthur Goldberg was leading that. He was head of Bally's at the time. And that turned out to be a real failure because it was perceived that the industry was coming in and trying to push gaming on the state.
The Seminoles like that or something.
Well, they weren't really that organized back then. They didn't have Jim Allen at that point.
They still have Jim Allen.
Yeah, they do.
Good for them. Let's face it, it's a business.
Mm-hmm.
I'm on board Caesars now. We hope, that I won't be in another month or so. But, it's a business.
And
the fact, I think, that really helped us, particularly when you mentioned the riverboats, it's going into some of the communities along the Mississippi and the other areas of what it would mean for the commerce in that town, the jobs in that town, the revenue for this city. Some of them were devastated because of the closing of the steel mills and so forth, particularly in the Midwest. And so we were a business that not only was profitable for the people who were shareholders in the business, but it was tremendously profitable for the communities who had the ability to work with us, and they had jobs and new houses, new businesses coming into the community. So it worked both ways.
Yeah, no question about it. But did you learn something from Florida that the growth, the drive for gaming had to be organic within the communities, and the industries had to support that?
Yeah, it was a little different in Florida, and I remember there were a couple of people who were in Texas also was a problem that they just some people just didn't want it, and there were people with some clout. In fact, the first time I really went and had a talk was the former Attorney General of the United States just in the last couple of weeks.
Right.
She was then, Pam was the Attorney General of Florida, there was just some opposition you could say the majority of Floridians didn't want it.
Right.
It was some of the people who were the decision makers who wanted to make sure that they were taken care of.
Right.
I think that's what happened.
Sure. So when you stepped down as president, I think you could have stayed as long as you wanted.
Yeah.
What was your decision to step down in 2013?
Well, like I said, I agreed to only do it for a year. My wife and I had the house that she wanted her entire life. It was a house in Reno.
Mm-hmm.
And when President Reagan, after we reelected him and got every state but one, said to me, he called me on the phone, and because I didn't get out to leave after the 1984 budget. And he said, Frank, I thought you were like Old Man River. And I said, I'm sorry, Mr. President. He says, I thought, I'm rolling along for four more years, and I thought you were going to roll along with me. And I said, well, sir, you have a 4-year term. I have a 2-year term. He said, well, I want you to roll along with me. So what was I going to say? I called Mary. She wanted to go back to the dream house. And we never got back, unfortunately. I stayed on. And I did go back and practice some law. A big, very successful, good law firm in Washington. And it was just a great run for me, and I was very proud of the job that we did that was for the gaming industry. And we ended up with another dream house, which we're now getting rid of, in the Washington, D.C. area. And then I started serving on a lot of boards. At one time I was on 12 public company boards at the same time. I'm now down to 10.
Right. So, okay.
And that, so that's what I do.
Right.
Most of the time, I don't. And then, of course, I've got. I'm very involved still with the Commission on Presidential Debates, which even though we started in '88, and we couldn't go forward last time because President Biden was just not physically right. able to stand on the stage for 90 minutes yeah. and answer questions, and they wouldn't debate. Trump agreed to debate, and but we're still there. We're working now in 35 countries around the world, mm-hmm. working with the non-governmental entities to create debates, leaders in their country, and it's going extremely well.
Yeah,
I'm on the board of the Ted Kennedy Foundation. I think I'm on the board of the Eisenhower Foundation. I still do a lot of things with the Reagan organization. So there are other things that
I
do
in my life. You were on the board of the Culinary Institute for a while as well.
I was on the CIA board for many, many years.
Which is an intimate connection with the
game. The thing, why that happened was... a friend of mine, named Bill Anton, was very, very involved, and he came to me and said, you know, we've got this wonderful school, but they always are looking for places where these kids can do internships mm-hmm. and learn, and Vegas has just gone now, and they started having the great restaurants
right.
Open. So why don't you come on the board? And I said, okay. And we started that relationship. But I was on that board for a long time. And it worked out great. And, you know, boy, I'll tell you what, the restaurants in Las Vegas
sure.
are incredible. And they're incredible training grounds for some of our students at the CIA, which were not only up in New York, we're also in the Napa Valley
sure.
In California.
Great. So let's talk about the industry's largest trade show, which the AGA created in around the year 2000. Prior to that, it was the World Gaming Congress was owned and operated by the leading magazine at the time, International Gaming and Wagering Business Magazine, and they came to you or you came to them and wanted a bigger piece of the show. And they tell us what happened there.
Well, I started reading the magazine, and I knew that they were making a lot of money mm-hmm. for the show, and I said, as far as I know, the industry's not getting anything out of it. The publicity that they're buying to
right.
get their story in it. You were involved in those days. You were writing
right.
it. And so I said, let's go talk to them. And so I sat down with him. I can't remember the fellow's name. I think I met him in England first time, because mm-hmm. That's where their headquarters were, I
yeah.
think.
Yeah.
And then I met them in New York, and we cut a deal. And it went very well. What did we do, two or three sessions? And then I said, okay, look, we're doing this... You know, we're bringing a lot of people.
Growing like crazy. Yeah.
We yeah. sank the other two. They're two smaller
right, yeah, right. Shows
that went on, and they said, "Screw you."
Yeah.
So I said, "Screw you," and we started
right.
our own show.
Yeah.
And we've done pretty good with it over the years.
Yes.
And it was important. And then as Macau started going forward, Sheldon started it. Then Steve was in there, and then it was the time I went over. See what was being accomplished, and we opened up the show in Macau.
G2E Asia, right?
Yep.
And now it is one of the biggest shows in the industry. It's certainly the largest one in North America. Explain, how that worked for the AGA. Obviously, you got a lot of the revenue out of that.
The revenue out of that, we were able to, then supply the staff. We would help organizations. That were working in each of the states as much as we could. And it was just the source of not having to go back and ask continuously our members,
right.
the companies that have to pony up more
right.
dues and so forth. And one of the mistakes I think we made, to be very candid, when we started, the Indians were not invited to participate.
Right. Yeah.
And it was for a particular reason. Many members of the board were deeply concerned with what type of regulatory control tribes would mm-hmm. have. And the theory was that, or the feeling was that the worst thing that could happen to our industry was that there would be a major, major problem at one of the tribes or a number of tribes with regard to there wasn't regulatory control and so forth, and would create a terrible, terrible PR and so forth. So that was a real, real worry. And I got to know some of the tribes. I visited them, all the rest of them, and I never was really totally satisfied. In those days, you may remember, I represented Wayne Newton.
Sure.
And a lot of things. And Wayne actually wanted to start a casino with a tribe in California, I think it was. It was just a little nightmare. But I think looking back now, the tribes did a good job.
Yeah.
Now, there might have been one or two, you know, minor problems, but there were none of the major, major problems that most of the members of our board over the years were concerned with.
Right.
And so I think now they... long after I was done, there's some participation on the board of the AGA. So I think that was a mistake that we made back then, just being, again, the importance of good, strong regulatory control was something that we wanted to make sure that we didn't in any way cause a problem.
Right. And that kind of covered your opposition to online gaming at the time as well. I mean, there were so many illegal gaming, online gaming operators from offshore that were, you know, trying to pick off gamblers in the U.S. And I think that's why the industry didn't want to get involved in that.
Didn't want to get involved in it. I finally came to the conclusion there that something had to be done. And I talked to Sheldon, Sheldon Adelson. Was vehemently against anything regulating there. And he said, I have, I think, two sons, I think.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, they're teenagers, and I don't want them, you know, have to be involved in that. And Sheldon, right now, they can go online, and there's 2,000 offshore operators with no regulation whatsoever who they can gamble with. Well, isn't it better if we had a regulatory system that would protect the people who were playing? And I knew Sheldon, I loved Sheldon, and but Sheldon made up his mind.
Well, he had his mind made up, for sure.
He made up his mind, and I could never get him to.
I did an interview with him at G2E in around 2010, and I asked him that very question, and he bit my head off. But his staff was very happy that he did that, because they showed that it was just emotion with him, that he was so emotionally attached to that position, there was nothing they could do.
And talk about a guy who really did a positive thing about our industry, and was a great person from the standpoint of having a mind and thoughts. I can remember meeting him for the first time, I think it was when they were building what is now his operation in Las Vegas. He had a little shack there, a little building where he had replicas of the rooms that were going to be and so forth. And I went in and met with him, and he was such a creative.
He was.
A creative guy. And he and his wife never got the credit that they deserved with what they did to help people who were addicted to drugs.
Right.
They opened, I don't know how many of these units they had around the United States, but she took me to the one in Las Vegas.
Right.
And they had a relationship with the judges downtown, particularly with young people who had addictive problems. They would go to that clinic that they created, paid for, got no publicity of, and helping those kids get away from it.
Right.
So the Adelsons were someone with the industry should have great respect for, and I think they
were. Absolutely. I once interviewed her in her office in her little clinic, and I mean, it was in one of the worst parts of Vegas, and the office was tinier than this room, and it was wall to ceiling with papers and books and things of that nature. And she was so dedicated to that, and I know she still runs it. It's just an amazing, her heart is really into it, so I'm really happy to see that. So gaming has changed a lot. And let's talk about sports betting. That was something you pushed for a lot of years, people like John McClain oppose it. A lot of other, even some of the industry opposed the spread of sports betting. But eventually it happened. What do you think? How that's turned out so far?
Well, so far it's fun. I mean, in the last couple of years we've got some incidents of some of the professionals, interestingly enough, who were either shaving points or spreading information about who was going to play or not play, and so forth.
Some which referees, even.
Yeah, and so and I think that the regulatory control is there not only from the state organizations, but most importantly the leagues and so forth to try to. So I think there's always going to be a problem.
Right.
I mean, It's very much in a way like what I mentioned earlier with regard to the lotteries. You know, before there were the lotteries, you know, you could buy tickets in your neighborhood.
Yeah.
And the racket was there. And before there was betting, there was a lot of betting going on. And so I think the regulatory control that's been with as much as there is out there. And I mean, you know, if you just go into Caesars or you go to any of the major hotels and you see that you're going in and every game or horse race that's going on is on a camera, and you can watch it. The corruption, I think, has been minimal to what a lot of the people who were vehemently opposed to it thought was going to happen.
Yeah. So, again, let's go back to the prediction of markets. Because, you know, they are such a threat, and let's put that aside, where do you think the industry is going? Do you think we've expanded too far, or is there something we can do to create more support amongst the general public?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer, Raj. I don't. I mean, Bill would be better. Pat, you know, who took my place, and has done a good job. I think the AGA. I'm just not involved in as much. You know, I'm really concerned with Caesars, and that's where I stay. I don't do as much informing myself of what else is going on around the country. You know, I think, like with a lot of businesses, the question is going to be when this thing turned down and the companies aren't making the money. I mean, you realize what Las Vegas has gone through because of some of the things the President of the United States said about Canada. And the Canadians stopped coming. Mm-hmm. A lot of them stopped coming. And it hurt the industry.
Yeah.
So I think with regard to it spreading more, it's a question of whether or not a company can go involved, expand, and do well and pay their bills. And most of them are public companies, mm-hmm. and therefore you got shareholders and Securities and Exchange Commission and so forth and other factors. So I think right now I don't see any real dangers other than, you know, the market that's just coming back. And when things are bad with regard to the economy, people, you know, don't go. And it was always that question also, remember, when we started out with some of the regional, small regional operations, not the big hotel casinos like we have in Vegas and Atlantic City, as to whether or not there would be, you know, you could make money. That mom and pop were not going to go and stay in a hotel. They were going to drive maybe 2 hours, have dinner, mm-hmm. maybe see a show, play a couple of slots. But that didn't, it turned out that prediction was not right. More and more of them came, and I think when we came off of something in pond, what they called it, I'm trying to remember the name, where some of those boats were in just big ponds. It's very profitable operations in many, many states. And where it goes from here, I'm just not sure.
Sure. Well, we've purposely only stuck to gaming in this interview because that's what this podcast is all about. But I think I'd be remiss to not ask you about the state of the politics in the U.S. right now. We have a former casino owner as president, so that kind of ties in a little bit. But it seems like each side has been polarized. And you were known for your bipartisan efforts, with the debate commission and things of that nature. Why did we get so far apart? And do you think we can get closer together to really just work for the good of the country?
I am word sick about it. After I left the AGA, I was invited by Harvard, the Kennedy School at Harvard, to come and teach for run a seminar for a semester. And the class was told that my purpose was, whether or not we could turn around what's now a situation where the Republicans and Democrats, many of them in the Senate and the House, don't know their fellow members of Congress. It just doesn't exist. One of the things that happened, and I've said it for a long time, was there used to be, if there was a break, a chairman of a committee in the House or Senate would usually put together a delegation of maybe three or four Republicans, three or four Democrats, and their wives, mm-hmm. and they would travel to other countries to study problems and so forth. Now, a lot of people say, oh, the media said it's just a vacation they're getting and so forth. It, maybe it was in a way,
yeah.
but it also was a situation where they got to know each other,
mm-hmm.
where they got to know each other. The two best friends I had all the years I was in Washington were the two men who chaired the Democratic National Committee.
Yeah.
When I was chairing, Chuck Manatt and I worked together. He was California. In fact, maybe the interesting thing was that all three of us were lawyers.
Right.
And you know, when you try in cases and so forth, you can shake hands and so
yeah.
forth. And Chuck and I worked hard in creating the National Endowment for Democracy, which does democracy work all over the world. And Paul Kirk and I, who actually went in the Senate when Ted Kennedy died. He was chief of staff. Mm-hmm. Ted Kennedy, governor of Massachusetts, appointed Paul to fill the remainder okay. of his term until the next election. But we knew each other. Our wives knew each other.
Mm-hmm.
Our kids, particularly Chuck's kids, were friends with our kids. Mm-hmm. We went to dinner all the time. We worked together. And we needled each other.
Yeah, sure.
But we didn't hate each other.
Yeah.
And the difficult thing is when you do away with that relationship, when Chuck died, his family came to me and asked me to be the master of ceremonies at the memorial really? Service mm-hmm. for her husband's funeral. And I was in a church in Washington. I got Joe Biden was sitting in here, Nancy Pelosi in here, and they yeah. it was all Democrats,
yeah.
primarily. And I remember looking down at Joe and saying, Joe, you know, I'm going to play golf tomorrow with someone that you know. And I know you, Nancy, you know him. His name is Bob Michael. Bob Michael was the leader of the Republicans in the House for many, many years. And I looked at them and I said, do you know how Bob Michael got back to Illinois where he's a congressman on the brakes?
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them. I said, he shared a car with Dan Rostenkowski. Now, people who know in those days who Dan Rostenkowski was the most powerful Democrat in the House, he chaired the budget committees
right.
and so forth. They shared a car to ride back to Illinois. And I said, we don't see that anymore,
right.
that type of a relationship here. You can't trust somebody if you don't know somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And really very, very interesting remarks afterwards coming and say how much they enjoyed it and how much it was. So now you have hopefully some people
mm-hmm.
who want to go forward. But it's really tough right now,
yeah.
the way things are. It's a disgrace. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm really worried about my grandkids and
sure.
what kind of country we're going to have. It's just terrible. You know, I was a Republican chairman. I am a Republican. There are things that the president is doing that I totally disagree with. But that doesn't mean I hate him. Joe Biden made decisions that didn't mean I hate him. I still had a relationship with him. I think that when you have that, try to disagree agreeably is what I used to like to say. You know, when I did 33 presidential general election debates
mm-hmm.
where the Republican and Democrat candidates were there. It was through the Obama years, it was George H.W. Bush, and all of them. I was friends with the Democrats as well as I was friends with the Republicans, and you can work together to get things done. And I don't know how we're going to solve this problem. I wish I did. It's terrible what's going on. Now, the Democrats have their own problem
right.
what's going on with the what they call it, Democratic Socialist
right.
Party. I don't know what's going to happen with that. Although right now, as I view it, from my perspective, most of the success of those are taking place in blue cities
sure,
and states
right.
and so forth. And it's a real concern to me. I'm worried about the future of our country until the leaders of our country start treating each other with respect.
Yeah, very good.
I tell my kids and my grandkids, you don't have to want to be liked. It's not important to me that someone liked me, but I want them to respect me.
Right.
And that's the thing that's missing in politics
right.
today.
So is there anybody Do you have any family problems? Like, you know, there's some Democrat-leaning people in your family and who won't talk to the Republicans?
No. They don't. I've got some who never tell me how they vote.
Okay.
And but no, we don't argue about politics. Okay. And I think telling anybody is, please don't, around a dinner table, particularly Thanksgiving or Christmas or other places, don't talk politics.
Yeah,
you're
exactly.
Not going to get it.
Right. Well, Frank, thanks for taking the time to join us. I really appreciate this. You are a mentor to me and a lot of people I know. I appreciate what you've done for me, what you've done for the industry, and I hope to we can play golf sometime.
One of the things I'm proud of is I helped you get started.
That's right.
And
yeah.
You have done the same thing for our industry.
For sure. Yeah.
Being out there in the journalist side of it and spreading the news about our industry to the world. So thanks for having
Sweet.
Me.
Thanks, Frank.
Thanks for joining us on the Gaming Legacy Podcast, where we try to reveal how the industry was built, what changes have been made over the years, and why it's important to honor the founders of the gaming business. So we'll see you next time on the Gaming Legacy Podcast.